sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Alan Marinus, Dean of the Musar Institute, author of Everyday Holiness, Bill Gray Lectureship Scholar on Musar. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish Mavenah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, our maven on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. In Jewish tradition, there are four New Years, beginning with Rosh Hashanah in the fall, the New Year of the Soul. Tonight, we begin an unusual New Year, Rosh Hashanah La'ilanot, the Jewish New Year for trees, called Tu B'Shvat. It occurs midwinter every year. This is a kind of combination of Jewish Arbor Day and Earth Day, on which we celebrate the growth of the natural world, the many kinds of trees and the various fruits they produce, and our own connection to the ecology of our Earth. It is very good to be reminded annually, at the least, that we are very much dependent on the remarkable planet God has given us, its times and tides, its weather patterns and ecosystems, and its changes. By tradition, on Tu B'Shvat, 15th day of the Hebrew calendar month of Shvat, we plant new trees and celebrate with a Seder, remembering the progression of the seasons and the growth of the good earth that God created. That Tu B'Shvat Seder, the orderly meal in which the blessings we say and the food we eat celebrate God's role in our lives and our own responsibility to preserve and protect the earth, is a lovely opportunity to recommit to our beloved planet. The more famous Seder on the Jewish calendar, of course, is the Pesach Seder, Passover in the spring, celebrating freedom. But the Tu B'Shvat Seder, invented by the mystics in the town of Tzfat in Israel, is a lovely way to connect with our heritage and with God. More importantly, it's a reminder of the great commandment in Genesis that we are to be stewards of the earth, committed to tending the great garden God has given us. That responsibility extends to preserving the health and vitality of the natural world. Not only are we commanded not to destroy, we are enjoined to protect it, to heal it where it's injured, to seek to repair it when we damage it. Tu B'Shvat reminds us that we are, in a very tangible sense, rooted in the very earth of our planet. Its growth and our own are bound together. On this Jewish New Year for trees, may we each recommit ourselves to protecting our planet, working to repair it, doing true tikkun olam, repairing the world on an ongoing basis. Last week, we observed the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. To play us in this morning in the spirit of African-American and Jewish cooperation, here's a remarkable new collaboration between the popular Jewish a cappella group The Maccabeats and the outstanding African-American a cappella group Naturally 7, covering James Taylor's Shed a Little Light.
Let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King. And recognize that there are ties between us, all men and women living on the earth. Ties of hope and love, of sister and brotherhood. And we are bound together in our desire to see the world become a place in which our children can grow free and strong. We are bound together by the task that stands before us and the road that lies ahead. We are bound, we are bound.
There's a feeling like the clenching of a fist. There's a hunger in the center of the chest. There's a passage through the darkness and the mist. And though the body sleeps, the heart will never rest.
Shed a little light, oh Lord. Shed a little light, oh God.
There is a hunger in the center of the chest. Oh no.
There is a passage through the darkness and the mist.
Oh no. And though the body sleeps, the heart will never
rest. Oh,
let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King
and recognize that there are ties between us, all men and women living on the earth. Ties of hope and love, of sister and brotherhood.
That was Shed a Little Light, sung by the Maccabees of Yeshiva University and Naturally 7, a great African-American a cappella group from New York, recorded specifically for this year's Martin Luther King Jr. observance last Monday. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, Alan Marinus, Dean of the Musar Institute, author of the books Everyday Holiness and Climbing Jacob's Ladder, and the upcoming Bill Gray Lectureship Scholar on Musar at Temple Emmanuel, will explain what the Musar movement is all about, how that great Jewish ethical practice can change your own life for the better. Find out how when we come back on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Alan Marinus is the founder and dean of the Musar Institute, an active interpreter of the teachings and practices of the great Musar tradition. In many ways, he can be credited with the tremendous Musar movement that is afoot in America, and I guess around the world today, in Israel as well. His guide to Musar practice, Everyday Holiness, the Jewish Spiritual Path of Musar, was a kind of Bible for many people exploring Musar in the contemporary world. He has other books out on Musar. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why do you think there has been such an interest in Musar, which after all dates back, often the texts are well over a century old, two centuries old, in the recent world? What's the zeitgeist reason for it?
Some of the texts go back 10 centuries, back right to the 11th century, and even a bit older. I think the answer is actually pretty simple, which is that the world we live in is quite concerned with spiritual development and self-improvement. Oprah's done a lot, yoga and meditation and mindfulness, and there's just so much concern for the inner life in contemporary society. And in the Jewish world, in the organized Jewish world, that was largely overlooked, and that created a vacuum. And Musar is exactly that. It's a Jewish practice for inner living. And so when that vacuum became clear, it's made it almost inevitable that people like myself went looking back into the Jewish tradition to say, well and good, self-development, but what's the Jewish path of self-development? And there it was. There is the Musar tradition, which its history goes back 1,100 years, so it has authenticity and validity, but most people growing up in the latter half of the 20th century in the Jewish world experienced a Jewish world that was committed to the external and the community and really did not put the inner life of the individual on the agenda whatsoever. So it's really that corrective, because in the Jewish world, the concern for the outer has always been matched by the concern for the inner. And so that was an imbalance that I think just needed to be corrected, and that's what's drawn the interest back to this old and very venerable tradition of ours.
If you were to define Musar in a couple of sentences, how would you do so?
I wouldn't. Imagine, it's so hard because the tradition is 1,100 years old. There's so much to say about it. But in that sense, on one foot, it really is a Jewish path for personal, spiritual, and inner psychological and emotional development. But unlike many other traditions, the point of that development is not self-interest. So sometimes I define Musar as working on yourself, but not for the sake of yourself. Each of us has been given the gift of a holy soul. And the work of Musar is to uncover the radiance of that inner being that is our inherent gift in order to fulfill the Torah's injunction about what a human life is for. The Torah says very clearly, Kedoshim Tihiyu, you shall be holy. And the work of becoming holy is really about uncovering the innate, inborn holiness that is there and letting it shine into the world. Again, not for the sake of one's individual life, not to be famous or glorified, but in fact for the sake of the world. And I think one thing everybody will agree on is that this world needs more light, this world needs more holiness, and each of us has a portion that is there in potential in us that we can bring into the world through working on ourselves.
We will continue to explore how it is that Musar helps to bring holiness and to bring light into the world and how we can participate in that process when we come back with Alan Marinus in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have 3 stores. We're opening a 4th in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Bryce. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So I just came back from a rabbinic conference. I was talking to some rabbis who spent some time in Europe, including the head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, Danny Friedlander, and he was saying is that people are all concerned that the anti-Semitic activity and all of the unrest in France is leading the French Jewish community to leave. He said the moneyed people are not leaving. The poor Jews are not really leaving. The middle class Jews aren't leaving so much.
But the young people who are bright, energetic, the children of the people who not only have a place in France, but in Netanya and New York or San Diego or somewhere, those children who are in their either college age or post-college age are making aliyah or they're going somewhere else. And that while this doesn't damage the French Jewish community in the short run, in the long run, these are the future leaders and they're going. You know France as well as anybody I know and the French Jewish community as well. What do you think?
So I think the exodus of the demographic group that you described or that your colleague described to you has much less to do with anti-Semitic incidents or terrorist incidents than it does with the job market in France, which is very bleak. And a lot of young people with ambition and brains are leaving a lot of countries in the heart of Europe, but particularly France or Spain, because their professional opportunities are so limited, or at least their perception is. They have to wait 10 years after college to get a job. What are they going to do? Live with their parents for 10 years and then just to sort of march in place? No, they want to go someplace where the economy is more dynamic, and Israel is such a place. So if they grew up with a strong attachment to Zionist ideals, Israel is a logical place for them to move. Not so much running away from anti-Semitism, but running towards economic opportunity. And I think, you know, American Jews always focus on France, but anti-Semitism is on the rise in many European countries. And I think that's a result largely of the fact that the European economy is broken. And historically, when economic times have been hard, the Jews are often scapegoated and anti-Semitic incidents tend to rise. And Europeans' nerves are also frayed by the uptick in terrorist incidents and the arrival of massive numbers of refugees. And by the way, I would like to take this opportunity to plug shamelessly. Of course, I'm going to be teaching at the Jewish Community Center here starting on Monday, January 25th, for 6 weeks, except for Monday, February 1st. On the history of anti-Semitism and how we got to where we are today and how anti-Semitism has taken different forms over the centuries, what causes it, what can be done to combat it, its roots. And I think this is a course that might be of interest to some of your listeners. So I'm just mentioning people should go to the JCC website and look for this and sign up if they're at all interested in hearing more about this subject.
Fascinating subject. It does seem to me that, you know, when things go bad in Europe, it's time to blame the Jews. It's beginning to feel that way a little bit again.
Mm-hmm.
I hope there's a correction in the future. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Non, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach, Tu Bishvat is almost here. Tu Bishvat Higia, Chag Ha'ilanot, the holiday of trees.
Chag Ha'ilanot Sameach, Rabbi.
Thank you. Toda Rabba. It is also Tu Bishvat, by its nature, literally, the holiday of environmental awareness, consciousness, our stewardship of the earth. When I first went to Israel a million years ago, Israelis knew no more about protecting the environment than America did when you used to have rivers catching on fire. Mm. And the best place for trash was not in a trash can, but on the ground. That's changed very dramatically. Let's talk a little bit about the way Israelis think about the environment, protecting Eretz Yisrael. They may have loved the land, but they weren't good at protecting the environment.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for your opening. Yeah, I agree with you. Many years ago, many, many million years ago, maybe you were right. Now, Israel really, Tu Bishvat is well known more than one of the Rosh Hashanah.
One of the Jewish New Years. There's four of them.
Yeah, I don't know if more of this, kids will know, mainly kids, because education is through the kids, through the students. So most of the kids will know that Tu Bishvat is the holiday of recycling, the holiday of keeping the earth, you know, keeping the earth for the next generation. That's the way secular schools for sure will teach Tu Bishvat. So yeah, I think now Israel is one of the countries, one of the countries, nations that really help to preserve the nature, and it's good to know that it's a Jewish value. It's one of the important Jewish values to keep, you know, your land for the next generations.
You know, we talk a lot in the early history of Zionism about draining the swamps and irrigating the desert. All of that was true. I remember, however, the awful incident in the Maccabiah Games in the Yarkon River, mm-hmm. where the bridge collapsed, mm-hmm. The competitors, athletes from around the world, Jewish athletes, fell in. Some were poisoned by the water in the Tel Aviv's major river. Mm-hmm. Was that part of what led so much effort now in Israel to cleaning the rivers, preserving the environment?
Good point. Maybe there is a, you know, unfortunately, some of the very good laws was written with blood, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, but I think it's also a mega trend that, you know, Israel is very good in taking like mega trend. You know, we are very flexible. So every trend that new in the world, we are very easy to adjust. We are a small country, very flexible people.
And very technologically aware.
Doesn't need to plan a million years ahead. So it's easy for us to absorb new trends. So I think it's a combination of some tragedies and a new trend that actually goes very well with Jewish values.
With Jewish values, sure.
So it's a bingo.
Well, I hope it's a great and continually clean holiday of Tu B'Shvat. Chag Ha'ilanot Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John. Boker Tov.
Boker Or.
Tu B'Shvat is almost upon us, the holiday for celebrating the new year for trees,
right,
when sap begins to flow. It's a very important, naturally oriented festival, mm-hmm. greatest one we have probably in Judaism, and yet not well known and maybe not so well understood. How do you teach it?
How do you teach it? You teach it by doing. So much of learning is about doing. And last week I referenced, you know, planting a tree as a youth at the anti-Israel kindergarten program. So there are multiple ways that kids can get involved in connecting with nature. Whether or not you're going on a hike, you're spending time in a park, you're planting seedlings, planting a bean seed in a jar and watching it grow, classic science experiment for kids, but also teaching about the life cycle of the plant. So there are all kinds of ways to engage in that level. And then there's actual community service that can be done to help the environment. Planting trees. In Tucson, we work on removing buffel grass, recycling.
Cleaning up a park.
Cleaning a park, sure. Cleaning a neighborhood.
Right.
And also having an education and an understanding about the world in total, how the world interacts as an ecosystem, how impact in one area affects another area of the planet. So learning about these things are important as kids are growing up.
So how, as an educator with a school, do you navigate the challenges for people who, for example, don't believe in global warming or who challenge the science, no matter how strong the science is,
sure,
on the melting of the polar ice caps? When
sure.
You want to try to teach that?
Well, I think it's about setting the context for a conversation. And while we may not get into the dividing lines of who's wrong and who's right, although I certainly have my opinions about that, and most educators do, our job is to make sure that kids have the opportunity to know how to find information, how to get the facts, and how to sort out what might be blown up and exaggerated emotion versus factual information.
You know, it's fascinating. When I was doing my trip around the world last year, I was in India. Fascinating country, beautiful country, unbelievably polluted country.
Yeah.
And we don't always see the pollution in our own country as clearly.
Right.
But there's a lot of education to do everywhere in the world. But there's some education to do right here too.
Sure. And you know, we it comes full circle around to Tikkun Olam and about making the right decisions and having the framework, that kind of moral guidance of wrong and right, and making choices that don't just benefit yourself, but are also good for others, including global humanity.
And the whole planet itself.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, John. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Enjoy.
We'll talk next week. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you want to come on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please call 520-327-4501 or email tojewishradio, TOOJewishRadio18 at gmail.com. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Izzy and Herschel were brothers about whom nothing good could be said. They ran a crooked business, they womanized, they lied, they cheated the poor, but they were also very, very wealthy. When Izzy died, Herschel went to Rabbi Bloom and said, "I'll donate to the synagogue $100,000 if you say at the funeral that my brother Izzy was a mensch." The rabbi thought long and hard, but eventually agreed. At the funeral, the rabbi told everybody present honestly about Izzy's wrongdoings, and then he finished with a sentence, "But compared to his brother, he was a real mensch." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Can you recite the Ten Commandments by heart? I suspect not. Most of us can't. We usually remember, "Thou shalt not murder," and then say it wrongly as, "Thou shalt not kill." And we remember, "Thou shalt not steal." But most people kind of remember there's something in there about honoring father and mother and not swearing. Others might get the adultery part, perhaps even the Sabbath day. Few people can remember all 10. Whether or not you know them by heart, these 10 statements from this week's Torah portion of Yitro are supposed to be the only words God ever spoke directly to our people. But they are not really at the heart of our Judaism today. Why not? We Reform Jews have trouble with many of the 10, to be honest. We struggle to find relevant ways to observe them. Nearly every commandment brings a problem along with it, even the most positively phrased. What does it mean to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy if we spend most of Shabbat working and wired in? I recall attending the URJ Biennial Convention in Toronto a few years back. hearing the president, Rabbi Eric Yaffe, then thank the delegates at services for celebrating a non-wired Shabbat free of cell phones. His remarks were immediately posted on Facebook by most of the delegates or tweeted using the same smartphones they were supposed to have put away during Sabbath services. Nearly all the commandments have complications. How are we to suitably honor fathers and mothers if they are challenging people or abusive? Not murdering or stealing seems clear, but how can we possibly avoid feeling jealous of our neighbor's better job or nicer car or happier life? And don't we take God's name in vain all the time without apparent repercussion? I believe the commandment we have the hardest time with among Reform, Liberal, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Progressive, all other non-Orthodox Jews may be the first one. It is the simple statement that there is a God who commands us. This first statement, which contains no apparent commandment to fulfill, "I am the Lord your God," has been considered by Christians a kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments, but we Jews have always insisted on viewing it as a unique and critical statement. That's because as logical as the Aseret HaDibrot may seem as a declaration of ethics in theory, if we don't accept the existence of a mitzvah, a commander, they lose their power. With no mitzvah, no commander, there's no mitzuveh, no recipient of the command, commandee, if you will. In practical terms, that means that the mitzvot are not really commandments that have to be kept at all. Philosophically, the warrant for the authority of the Ten Commandments lies in this simple statement: God exists, God acts, God commands. That's why these are not the 10 suggestions or the 10 recommendations or the 10 nice ideas, if you can manage it. It's only when we accept the existence of God, when we diminish our own elaborate sense of self, that we're able to partner with God to create a moral world. Only when we engage with the commander do we find commandment. It's up to us, on this week of Parshat Yitro, to find for ourselves the one who commanded them, however we conceive of God, to accept our role as recipients of ethical commandment. When we choose to do so, we'll find that we can be moral beings. We can shape this world in good ways. We can observe the Ten Commandments as they were intended to be observed by heart. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Alan Marinas, leading teacher of contemporary Musar, will explain just how this simple but deep practice can change you and potentially your life for the better. Find out all about it when we return on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In in a brutal attack, Daphna Meir, a mother of six, was stabbed to death in her home in the West Bank settlement of Otniel last week, defending her own children who survived but saw their mom murdered before their eyes. A 15-year-old Palestinian Arab terrorist was arrested later in the week. Daphna Meir is survived by her children, ages 4 through 17, and her husband, Natan. Meir was a licensed nurse who specialized in gynecology and operated a woman's clinic in Otniel. The U.S. State Department condemned this latest attack. "We are appalled and deeply saddened by the death of Daphna Meir," said the State Department spokesman John Kirby. "These horrific incidents underscore the importance of affirmative steps to restore calm, reduce tension, and bring an immediate end to violence." There are no really appropriate words for the continuing outrage of the Palestinian Arab terror campaign of stabbings. The fact is, 24 Israelis and one American have been murdered by Arabs in these brutal attacks. The other fact is that 145 Palestinian Arab terrorists have been killed trying to perpetrate these horrors. You would think they would learn. It's very sad and very tragic. George Wiedenfeld, a Holocaust survivor who repaid a debt of honor to those who saved him by bankrolling the rescue of Christians from ISIS, has died at 96 years old. The British Jewish publishing magnate credited Christians with helping him escape the Nazis and went on to build one of the most influential publishing houses in England. George Wiedenfeld was one of the most remarkable figures of post-war Europe, said former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, an extraordinarily successful businessman, philanthropist, and thinker. He was a supreme influence on a generation of European politicians. I benefited enormously from his wisdom and his encyclopedic knowledge of the world. Born in Vienna in 1919 and a graduate of the University of Vienna, George Wiedenfeld escaped Austria for the United Kingdom in 1938 at the age of 19, following the German invasion and Anschluss. After working at the BBC Overseas Service, Wiedenfeld obtained British citizenship in 1947, and later, with his business partner Nigel Nicholson, founded the publishing house Wiedenfeld & Nicholson. Wiedenfeld & Nicholson is best known as the house that first published Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita in 1959, a novel that had been banned in Britain for years prior. Books like Prime Minister Harold Wilson's New Deal for Coal, Isaiah Berlin's The Hedgehog and the Fox, James Watson's The Double Helix all established the reputation of Wiedenfeld's publishing house. Later became the home of political memoirs from Lyndon Johnson, Golda Meir, and Henry Kissinger. "He was a tireless worker for Israeli, Jewish, and other causes," said British Jews President Jonathan Arkush, serving as Israeli President Chaim Weizmann's aide for a year after the state's founding. Last year, Lord Wiedenfeld launched an initiative to rescue 20,000 Syrian Christians from the civil war in Syria. The Wiedenfeld Safe Havens Fund was intended as a tribute from a survivor of the Holocaust to those Christians who had helped him and other Jews escape Nazis before it was too late. Last July, 150 Syrian Christians were airlifted to Warsaw as part of that project. "I had a debt to repay," Wiedenfeld said. "It applies to so many of the young people who were on the Kinder transport. Quakers and other Christian denominations brought those children to England. It was a high-minded operation. We Jews should be thankful and do something for the endangered Christians." Wiedenfeld certainly did. May we all be inspired by him and continue to do so, and may his memory bring blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Alan Marinus is the founder and dean of the Musar Institute, an active interpreter of the teachings, traditions, and ethical practices of the Musar tradition. He is the author of Climbing Jacob's Ladder, Everyday Holiness, Everyday Holy Day, series of books about Musar, and has been a formative influence in the development of what has been called the Musar movement here in America and really in Canada and around the world. Tell us, Musar explores character qualities, characteristics, midot, traits. What is the distinction between the way that Musar explores these and the way that, for example, psychology or psychotherapy would explore these same qualities that we struggle with?
To a large extent, they overlap. I mean, there really is no such thing as a psychological anger or a Musar anger or a Buddhist anger or, you know, anger is anger, and envy is envy, and humility is humility. So the focus within Musar is on those sorts of characteristics, those inner traits, and a wide range of them. And I suppose the place of differentiation is in some of the things where it isn't entirely clear, it isn't self-evidently clear what we're talking about. And I'll give just two examples. And here you find a Jewish understanding of those traits. One of them is humility. It's central to spiritual practice, much in line with what I was saying in the opener, that you work on yourself in the way of Musar, but not for the sake of yourself. That's a kind of humble approach right there. You're not self-serving. Well, what does humility mean? That's not self-evident, not like anger or envy, where we kind of know the experience. Humility needs to be defined. And through the centuries, going right back to the Talmud, in fact, in the Jewish tradition, our wise ancestors worked up a definition which has to do with occupying your rightful space. Humility is not shrinking to be completely negligible, a dish rag, a doormat. That's not a Jewish view of humility. Humility is occupying your rightful space, which means neither too much nor too little. You're not supposed to take over anybody else's space. That's arrogance. But if you don't occupy your space, then you're not coming up to your rightful space. And some people in the cultivation of humility need to learn to take up more space, others to take up less. Another example is patience. And often I find when I'm dealing with this quality with people today that people don't know what patience is. And if you're held
I'm sorry, I must interrupt you. I don't have the patience to listen to this.
Which is a question of, do you not have the equanimity to put up with me, or do you not have the forbearance to deal with your own emotions around putting up with me? Some people think patience is just being as calm as a lake in Minnesota in October at 6 o'clock in the morning. Patience is just, you will never be ruffled. You have unlimited resources. Other people say patience is, you're already riled up. You want to kill somebody, but you don't. So which is it? Is it equanimity or is it forbearance? And the Jewish teachers have come down very strongly on the side of forbearance. The word for patience in Hebrew is savlanut. And it's related to two other words. You can hear it in the vowels themselves. I'm sorry, in the consonants. Savlanut is related to the word sevel, which means suffering. And it's also related to the word sabal, which means a porter. So in the Jewish view, patience is bearing your own suffering. This is driving me crazy, and I just want to get there, and you're in my way, and you're, you know, and then all goes all the anxiety and all the agitation. Patience is the ability to create a big inner vessel and hold that. You're not denying it. You're just watching it. You're just accepting that that's what's there, and you've got big enough shoulders to just bear the burden of those feelings. So that's just two examples where our ancestors, sometimes burying the meaning right in the word itself, help us understand things we may never really reflected on in our own inner life in order to come to a pretty clear understanding of what am I feeling, what am I experiencing, and what's the ideal that I could work towards to cultivate myself to become closer to the potential of what I have in my own life, but in the Jewish view, closer to being the vessel of holiness that is the mandate of every human being.
You know, growing up, I think I had a pretty fair Jewish background. My dad's a rabbi and a cantor. My grandfather was a rabbi. I went to all kinds of Jewish schools. I did not have a single class in Jewish mysticism until I accidentally kind of bumped into it after I was already a cantor. I'm still waiting for my first structured class in Musar. What's the relationship between mysticism, spirituality, and Musar, and why has there been such a resistance to incorporate this into more mainstream Jewish education?
Yeah, it's so interesting. There's a lot to say about that. I mean, in many ways, Musar is not a mystical tradition. It's a very practical and, in some sense, even very worldly tradition, because it deals with our everyday experience. That's the field of action. So when you get up into the higher realms of the abstract and the dematerialized, the Musar teachers tend to want to bring you back to say, yeah, but how are you treating your children? Yeah, but how do you drive? How are you when you're in the supermarket? You know, and those sorts of things. The everyday life is really the manifestation of your actual spiritual reality. And so there's a tendency not to want to get distracted into the metaphysical when, in fact, we have so much work to do in this world we inhabit on a daily basis. It does still end up connecting to the mystical because we're talking about the soul, and that gives rise to all kinds of questions just about existence itself and about death and about life after death and about reincarnation. And those are sort of unavoidable subjects, but they never become the focus. The focus is the decisions and the actions and the feelings and the words you bring into every moment. I've even heard holiness described as exquisite sensitivity to the other. That it's that concerned with how you are in the real world, not to get distracted into thinking abstract thoughts when in fact there's a reality right in front of you to deal with. I think the reason there's been resistance to mysticism and Musar has a lot to do with just, again, as you were saying earlier, the zeitgeist of the time. The Jewish world has been so concerned with intellectual development, with rationalism, with building buildings and building communities, with building just the institutions of the Jewish world, as well with affluence, with materialism, with assimilation, just becoming part of the mainstream of American culture, which I say not in criticism, because when you consider how long our ancestors were excluded from the mainstream of the societies in which they lived, there was a kind of pent-up centuries-old desire that burst forth when it became possible. Now we could live in any suburb we wanted. We could join any club we wanted. We could run for political office. We could do whatever we wanted. And people took up the opportunity. That, combined with the materialism of the modern world and the assimilation that that's all led to, has meant that things like the inner life and mysticism and things that were just a little less substantial, a little less mainstream, were not just ignored, they were kind of pushed away actively because they didn't fit with the agenda. That makes sense. The problem was that the Jewish world became unsatisfying because we have inner lives that are a high priority for us. What we feel, what we love, what we don't love, what we fear, what we experience, how we trip over our own inner qualities, how we mess things up, all that is so central to our life. And if we weren't going to get that in the Jewish world, we were going to have to go elsewhere. And the truth is, today, you can't do a Buddhist meditation retreat that isn't led by somebody named Goldstein, Burstein, Kornfeld, Schwartz, Salzburg, exactly. Rosenberg. I did not make up any of those names. No. Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfeld, Sylvia Burstein. That's because...
Salzburg, yeah. I mean, these are famous Buddhist teachers in America in 2015,
exactly.
2016.
And that's a reflection back on the Jewish world turning to the external, understandably. And that's not a criticism, but it created an imbalance. And so that affected rabbinic education, that reflected very strongly in communal leadership, like federations and JCCs and that sort of thing. And that's all changing now. I do work with the Jewish federations. The leadership of schools, rabbinic schools as well, that's all changing because it is just a fact of life that we have inner lives and they need to be attended to in a Jewish context because that's who we are. And if we don't attend to them in the Jewish context, well, people will just go elsewhere. And we've seen that in too many numbers.
So let's take it from a beginner approaching Musar, someone who wants to come hear you speak, and they're interested in exploring their inner life, and they're not sure how to go about starting. How should they start?
Well, probably the same way I did, which is doing some reading. You know, one of the gifts of our ancestors in this tradition is that they wrote their thoughts down. And the way I was able to encounter the Musar tradition myself was just by going to the library, literally going to a library, and looking up books in the catalog and taking them out and reading some of these old texts. Because of my background and just my own personality, I found it possible to delve into these many medieval texts. Many of the texts are medieval. They're not easy, but I liked doing that, and that gave rise to my own activity in the field. That led me to write books myself, as you mentioned in the introduction, and the reason I did that is to make the tradition more accessible. So in a highly non-promotional way, I would say that that my purpose in writing my own books was to give people access to the teachings that were originally written in Hebrew, some of them written in Arabic, many of them written hundreds of years ago. They're not very accessible, kind of content-wise, to the modern sensibility. And that's why I've written my own books for that purpose. So that's a good place to start. And the other good place to start is on the web at musarinstitute.org. We've created a website which has a wealth of information and sources there that you can access. And ultimately, if one is interested, then also there we provide study materials and courses and learning partnerships and all the support we could think of to help someone on their own spiritual journey really track a Jewish path for their spiritual activity and growth.
Last question. Your own doctorate came from Oxford for studying Hindu pilgrimage. You've studied yoga. You've studied many Buddhist meditations, so both Hindu and Buddhist traditions. And yet you returned to Judaism through Musar. Maybe that's a guide for many people, that you can find what you're looking for if you start even at home.
Right, although sometimes you have to wander to find it. What I've come to realize is that our generation is really a generation of spiritual orphans. Most of us, 99% of us, did not receive a direct transmission of spiritual teachings from the previous generation. You had a father who was a rabbi. That might have been different, but that's got to be included in the 1%, not the 99%, whose parents were very involved with contemporary life and making a go of it and not passing on, and maybe never having received themselves the spiritual traditions and spiritual teachings of the Jewish world. So we as a generation are, in a sense, orphaned from our own ancestral traditions, and that's led to a lot of wandering. And the wandering has not been bad, because it's taken us to places where we've seen this and we've seen that, and that's given rise to questions and brought many of us back to the Jewish tradition with a kind of demand to say, I want my spiritual life to be guided on a Jewish path, and I want my tradition to step forward. And it's there. It's just taken a kind of wandering and exploration to once again rediscover what our ancestors knew so well, and that they, thank God, and very compassionately marked out for us, was that life is a journey of the soul. That's what life is. Each of us is a soul on a journey. How we do it, where we put our feet, the direction we go in, much of that we can learn from previous generations. Because even though the world has changed so much, human nature has not. And the lessons of the previous generations apply. And we're wise to learn from them rather than having to make it all up on our own and learn the lessons all over again.
You can learn much more from Alan Marinus at the Bill Gray Scholar in Residence weekend, February 4th through 6th at Temple Emmanuel. You can go to templeemmanueltucson.org to find out more. And you can go to
Mussar Institute, M-U-S-S-A-R Institute.org for more information. Alan, thank you so much. We look forward to
it. Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Ted Merwin, author of the very fun new book, Pastrami on Rye, an overstuffed history of the Jewish deli. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes for the holiday of Tu B'Shvat from Israeli singer Shalom Chanuch. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, because man is a tree of the field, based on Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 19, which explores our obligations to protect the earth. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach for Tu B'Shvat, a good holiday of Tu B'Shvat, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, Kmo Adam. Gam ha'etz umeach.